going to begin a time of exploration together, focused on a teaching that I have learned about from my teacher, Kempo Pema Wangduk, over the years. And as I mentioned, this is a truly beloved text in all Tibetan lineages. And it's thought to be a very comprehensive way of working with the mind and the heart so that we can methodically really work very deeply through our own obstacles toward fullest well-being, right? Fullest wakefulness. And so the Bodhisattva's way is understood to be a method, a roadmap for awakening, for enlightenment. And it offers a very thorough but also accessible understanding of the foundational teachings of the Buddha Shakyamuni. And so we're going to take our time to explore these teachings together. I understand that last month, Gus gave a wonderful Dharma talk on the Bodhisattva's way, what it means to be a Bodhisattva. And so I'll say a few words about that, but I'm also going to speak about how to contextualize this practice. Because we live in a place where the Buddha Dharma is very available, but can sometimes seem a little decontextualized, right? It can sometimes feel like it's a purely secular endeavor, that it's up to our capacity to sit on our cushion, right, work with our mind, and to do so to the best of our ability, right, so that we can feel better. Right? We can have less anxiety, less chronic nagging concerns, right, less anger, all of our psychological and emotional struggles that can sometimes really interfere with that sense of well-being. And all of that is true, and it's a welcome part of our experience. But in the teachings of the Bodhisattva's way, we're also really encouraged to always remember why we're doing this practice, right? We do so for the benefit of all. Yeah, for the benefit of all. And this is really the Bodhisattva's way, right? The Bodhisattva is an image, is a symbol in the Tibetan tradition of the being who forestalls their own entry into nirvana, right? Who says, I'm not going anywhere until everybody is free from suffering. Until every single human being, whether I personally know them, whether I agree with their politics, right, whether we have anything in common, right, whether they like me or not, this is tough, right? It's very, very challenging stuff, right? Conceptually, we would all agree, sure, it makes sense, right? To be a good human being, to be open-hearted means that we have to soften our personal biases. But actually practicing this is enormously challenging. And so in the Bodhisattva's way, we're really encouraged just to remind ourselves before we study, before we read the text, which Pamela very kindly, I think, emailed to all of you, why we're doing this. It's really for the benefit of all beings, right? So that we can all feel cared for, we can all feel our deepest value beyond anyone's limiting judgment. We can all really trust our capacity to be agents for healing, right? Agents for the well-being of this world. And so the Bodhisattva's way has incredible integrity, right? It is a very inclusive circle, a very pervasive circle. Yeah. And the author, and I'm not sure if Gus talked about this, but the author of The Bodhisattva's Way was a beloved Buddhist teacher named Shantideva, who had an interesting story. He was a monastic, a student at the Nalanda University, which was the original Buddhist university in India. And he was thought to be an extremely mediocre student, somebody that his peers did not respect. He wasn't a smart guy, he wasn't articulate, he was not motivated, he was not ambitious. We might refer to him as a modern-day slacker. And so even the story is very interesting because we all tend to have almost immediate unconscious biases around, right, everyone in our life. So a slacker, right? We would write off a slacker, not someone we can learn from. Right, and so the mind can then shut down, right, to what's possible, what can be accessed. And so the story goes that, you know, he had been the butt of a lot of jokes about how limited he was, and, you know, he was only capable of the most primal capacities. And then one day, he sits down and he delivers this Dharma poem, which became this beloved text, The Bodhisattva's Way. And this was a comprehensive, thorough exploration of all the skillful means needed to open the heart, a very nuanced understanding of wisdom, the wisdom teachings of emptiness, right, and the capacity to fully awaken. So in a way, Shantideva was a challenge, right, to how we misperceive ourselves and others. Because we can sometimes lift to consciousness how we're seeing others, but we might struggle to do that with ourselves. Right? There might be a way in which we write ourselves off, or we don't sufficiently appreciate our own capacity for insight, for compassion, right, for spiritual development. And so I love the story of Shantideva because it's a wonderful challenge to how we have a tendency to insufficiently recognize and appreciate what we're all truly capable of. Yeah. So I'll read you, actually, I brought a couple of books to show you. One is the Dalai Lama's The Bodhisattva Guide. And this is a wonderful resource. It's based on his teachings that he gave in France just over 25 years ago on the Bodhisattva's Way. And so when you're reading, you're really in conversation with him. But he reminds us how the text begins. And there are different translations, but this one is, "To those who go in bliss, the Dharmakaya they possess and all their heirs, to all those worthy of respect, I reverently bow. Right? According to the scriptures, I shall now in brief describe the practice of the Bodhisattva discipline. To all those worthy of respect, I reverently bow." Right? In other words, I take refuge. I go for support in order to bolster my determination to become a bodhisattva. Now, I find this to be a very, very powerful teaching. And I'll just circle back to where I began, that it can sometimes feel like it's up to us alone to grapple with these teachings and then to integrate them into our life. Right? How is it going to happen when we have all of our personal struggles? right? And especially for those of us, and I think that's true probably for all of us, who are not monastics, and so we have families to take care of and jobs to do, right? A lot of competing responsibilities. Sometimes there's this sense of impossibility, right? Or being drawn back into distraction, right? Again and again. And so in this opening stanza, Shantideva is reminding us that while there's truth that we really do need to have a strong sense of investment, right, a strong determination, equally we need to be supported, right? Because we're relational, we really need resources. And so in the Buddhist tradition, this is referred to as going for refuge. Right? I go for refuge to the what's known as the triple gem, as we've explored in previous gatherings. Right? The Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Right? And so when Shantideva is referring to those worthy of respect, it's a reference to the beings who have worked quite hard, right, maybe for countless lifetimes, depending on your beliefs, to contact inner resources of insight and clarity, right, so that they can engage with life with a sense of wakefulness, right, a deep curiosity, a non-reactive presence. That we really need those beings to help us feel inspired, right? To help us feel that it's worth it to keep trying. Right? This is why people love to go hear His Holiness, and they love to hear other teachers, like a teacher that Pamela mentioned, and Pema Chodron, and many others, and Sharon Salzberg. Yeah. We need that sense of possibility, right? Because in the Buddhist tradition, Buddhas are not, they're not exceptional beings. They're not people who were born with an exceptional capacity for awakening. They're just like us, right? With all of our problems and our vexing personal struggles, right, and our longings that sometimes feel a little maddening because, right, the fulfillment can sometimes always feel a little bit out of reach. Right, the Buddhas are just like us. And so the idea is that we all have the needed resources to work very deeply with the mind, right, very deeply with the heart, in order to be fully awake, to not have to defend against certain parts of reality. That's really, that's what a Buddha is. It's just that doubt can creep in very easily. Right? If you're like me, you might notice your own neurosis and think, I'm entirely too neurotic to ever be fully awake, you know, maybe several lifetimes from now. And you might be gathering evidence. Look at how I behaved 5 minutes ago, right? Yesterday, the day before yesterday. Filled with angst, mildly irritated, right? Ready to explode, whatever it is, right? Secretly resentful, you name it, the list goes on.
Not secretly
resentful, right? Emitting resentment. Yeah. Right, so there's a lot of evidence that we can collect to fuel doubt, which is in part why going for refuge to our inspiring teachers, our Buddhas, is so important. And His Holiness reminds the reader in this text that whenever we begin the process of reading the Bodhisattva's Way, we start by just evoking that sense of going for refuge. And so as we've practiced, and we'll do so when we have a longer meditation in a little bit, the traditional prayer is in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, I go for refuge until enlightenment is reached. Through the merits of giving and other virtuous deeds, may I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all. So it's a beautiful, very pithy teaching, right? That I'm not in this alone. Because I'm relational, I need others to reflect to me what's possible. This is interesting, too, even in terms of neuroscience, right? We now know, because of our mirror neurons, it really matters what we're seeing, right? This becomes woven into our sense of who we are. And so if we have an awakened being, if we have someone who deals with life's weirdness and tumult, right, but non-reactively, it gets woven in, right, to our sense of self, our sense of our own capacity to be awake. Yeah. Yeah. In the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, I take refuge until enlightenment is reached. Through the merits of giving and other virtuous deeds, may I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all. And traditionally, that prayer is recited three times, and it's a combination of refuge and bodhicitta, which I'll say more about, right? Remembering that we are seeking wakefulness, right? We're trying to work very, very deeply with the mind in order to benefit countless beings, right? May I be a Buddha for the benefit of all, not just so that I'm suffering less stress and anxiety, although that's certainly included, right? That's part of the process. But to really actually intensify our understanding of just how healing it is, right? And we know this when we're feeling more trusting, we're feeling a little calmer, we're feeling safer. Our interactions tend to be more harmonious, right? And then there's a ripple effect. Right, the people we interact with are impacted by that sense of safety, and then the people they impact, etc. Right, so this idea is we can work deeply. We need inspiration. We need to go for refuge. And to know that we're all going for refuge all the time, but it's usually not conscious. Or it's semi-conscious. Well, whatever it is, it's that slice of pizza, right? That cold beer, that Netflix fourth episode. Whatever it is, it's actually a process of going for refuge. Right? If it were more conscious, what we would be thinking and feeling is, may the slice of pizza eliminate my suffering for the benefit of all. It's just not usually that conscious. Yes, for sure. Yes. Beautiful. Right, so no need to deprive yourself, because with the right intention, it's just that there's usually so much more, right, going on that we're not aware of, which is just the nature of the human mind, right? The conscious levels, the semi-conscious levels, and the unconscious levels. And so this prayer is a way of lifting to consciousness that we really do need support, right? We really do need inspiration and care. the question is, where are we going for that support and inspiration? And can it deliver what we're after? Right? I mean, the slice, you could actually work with it spiritually. but most of the time, it just can't deliver the deeper longing to be cared for. It just doesn't have that capacity, right? And so when we're taking refuge, we need our teachers to inspire us, to remind us of what we're doing and what could be healing. But then we also need teachings, right? We need methods, and that's the Dharma, right? I take refuge in the Buddha and Dharma. And this, too, is very helpful to remember that we need a roadmap. Right? We really do need a roadmap. Otherwise, what tends to happen is a feeling of being somewhat out to sea, right? Just swimming about, trying to find our way. Maybe noticing some pretty rocks and shells and a beautiful fish that swims by, right? We'll do our very best, right, to make do with that feeling of being out to sea. But it's not orienting, right? It doesn't really give us a clear sense of what it is we're working on. And I will say, I have found this to be very touching over the years. I've met many, many people who expressed to me that they've been curious about Buddhism, right, and spirituality writ large for a long, long time, 30, 40, 50 years, but have never quite fully found their way into a particular community or a lineage or work with a teacher. And there's this awareness that while they've gleaned some insight and there's been value, they've still had the sense of being out to sea. And now they're really wanting that sense of reliable support. Reliable care. Yeah. And so the Dharma is a way to feel reliably supported as you're working deeply with your mind and in your heart. Right? To understand what's contributed to your experience thus far. The good, the bad, the weird, the confusing, whatever it is, the traumatizing, the shocking, whatever it is, to really try to understand, right, what in your mind and in the minds of others has created the conditions for those experiences, and what's needed to work them through. So that you do feel more open, more trusting, more spacious, more equipped, right? Really equipped to be in life. Yeah. So I notice that whenever I sit down to practice and to reflect, I mean, I've read this book many, many times, and it was such a blessing to know that I would be with you all so that I could open it again and begin again. And each time, doesn't matter, the 13th, 14th, 25th time, each time there really is the sense of a reliable roadmap. It's not that we can't bring questions. Right? You might read, especially if you read the classical text, you might come upon certain stanzas that don't actually sit right with you, right? Where you might think, what's going on here around gender? right? Or what's going on here around absolutes of right and wrong, right? Evil and good. And so I welcome, right? I welcome your questions. And this is just part of the Tibetan lineage and all lineages to bring ourselves with deep curiosity and to allow for the doubt or the skepticism when it arises and to stay with it, see what's there. Yeah. So these are the first two jewels in the triple gem, the Buddha and the Dharma. The third source of refuge, the third jewel, is Sangha, right, or spiritual community. And I must say, I know I've talked about this before and we've explored this before, but I think it's really worth revisiting just how important it is to feel supported by community. As many people have shared with me in terms of that sense of being out to sea, what's connected to it often is not feeling in relationship to a community, not feeling that they're known by a community or getting to know a community, and therefore in some way feeling too on their own, right? And the mind is a very complex place to navigate on one's own. It really is extraordinarily complex, right? It holds our own personal history. It also holds our parents' history, our parents' parents' history, our culture's history. There's a reason why we understand the mind as being dynamic, because there's a lot going on in the psyche, right? And it is for this reason that we really do need others to help us hold this complexity. That on one's own, it becomes too much. Which is why we develop protective defenses against that complexity, right? When we're overloaded, when we're flooded by the enormity of what we're carrying, then parts of the mind say, it's too much, right? It's too much to think about. It's too much to reflect upon. And in psychoanalytic jargon, we would refer to that as struggles with mentalization, right? When something scary has happened to us, especially in childhood, something overwhelming, right, something traumatizing, a very effective mode of defense is to shut down our capacity to think about it and to hold in mind the contents of another person's mind. Right, so if someone seems to have malintent toward us and we need that person, right? One way we survive is just to shut down reflection. And it's a very effective way of surviving. To a point. And then eventually, we need to be able to reawaken our capacity to think about the complexity and to feel into the truth of what's happened. And the historical Buddha, because I think he really was so psychologically oriented, said, it's too much to do that alone. That is a courageous and at times terrifying endeavor. We need Sangha. We need people who care deeply about what's most important to be there as reliable sources of refuge. Now, if you're like me, this can be a little uncomfortable, right? Because it can feel safer to try to go it alone, Right? I mean, community tends to be a little messy, right? Like any group, family, ugh, forget about it. It's messy and usually problematic. And so again, I think many of us have protective impulses and parts that say, there's a lot of great literature and there are a lot of good teachings online. I can work this out. And I'm all for using those resources, but also to remember, right, these ultimate sources of refuge. People who inspire us reliably, which doesn't mean they aren't human. They don't have their shortcomings. They are and they will. But are good enough, right? Are open enough, stable enough that they inspire us to keep going. We need roadmaps that are orienting us toward what actually opens the mind rather than momentarily offers comfort. And we need a group. We need a comfortable enough, not perfect, healthy enough, good enough, comfortable enough group. Right, this is a perfect example. Right, to come together and reinforce that these efforts at awakening are going to manifest. Right, they're going to manifest in something deeply healing. Yeah. So, I think I can see that. I'm going to pause, but before I do, I want to just share that before I came here this morning, I had turned on NPR and I was listening to the jazz program, The commentator was saying, I hope that at your Sunday brunch there's a wonderful pairing. You're hearing this jazz, you're having great food, and then he was riffing off of the great wine pairing with a wonderful dinner. And I thought, this is a reliable pairing, right? Time, we have time, which is extraordinary, right? We have curiosity about our spiritual development, right? And then we have that determination to be together, to explore a very sacred text. It's the perfect pairing, right? Very, very optimal pairing.